medical purposes in the fine worsted. A small amount, 1 or 2%, was used in the processing of the wool or the dyeing of the wool. You got, is it going through?
Fine.
And it formed a loose chemical compound which preserved the wool from degradation and breaking down, which might happen in the process. For example, in the bleaching process, it tended to preserve the fiber, the strength, and the elasticity. And finally, the finished wool, since it was held on as a loose chemical, it gave a certain nice feeling and smoothness and lubricity to it. That was in the wool. I mean, the fine worsted industry for wool. Now, I used to attend the Gordon Research Conferences on fibers, etc. One gentleman that was there one time gets talking, and I find he's an ex-cancer and skin expert who's working for the Clairol Corporation. And I also learned that he had just become vice president and head of all the research. And talking about hair, and I said, you know, hair and wool are very similar. They're all the same kind of a fiber. We're manufacturing a chemical that prevents wool, fine wool, from being degraded and broken down when it's bleached or treated. Maybe it has some use in hair. He said, in principle, in our business, a big part is treating hair with oxidizing agent before the dye is added, and there is a problem of the hair breaking down. So I said, why not try this and see? He said, fine. Some year of research, and they found that it did some of the things for hair. In this type of an industry, it takes a long time, and the product had to be made free of certain leads and other compositions. And gradually, this became an important chemical, and for many, many years, it was a prime ingredient in a number of the most famous of the women's hair preparations. It all comes from work and textile and fiber. Now, if two things had not happened, if we hadn't realized and looked that another industry, another thing was similar, and two, if a guy like me who was running the business didn't attend some research conferences that were mainly theoretical in the thing, this would never have happened. And this happens very often in many, many things that happened in the paint industry, similar. Meanwhile, we can't hold out one single thing like we can this big hair dyeing company. Clairol is a big thing, but that's an interesting story. And I think people should look for it often for a cross movement of things. I think it's an interesting story. Been a big, was a big item for many, it still is an item important with us. And of course we develop other chemicals for them too, starting from this.
Did that lead on Renify?
Yes, other things from that, there are other things I don't want to discuss in detail, I don't think it's quite, but there are other things which, using our knowledge of fibers in the textile industry, we're able to, with modifications, have it fit into human hair.
Your sales, just a remark in that direction, your technical people out in the field, do they themselves focus in one area of your operations?
No, most of them tend to focus in a territory, and they may have a number of things, a number of different types of finishing, but their job is to, well, we don't have men selling industrial chemicals working in the textile industry. It's separate sales, separate people. But their job is to constantly bring us what's happening in the trade and come back with things that are needed. And a big part of our work is on trying to find, work out things that are needed in the industry.
How do you, what's the nature of the person who, where do you look for people who have that technical background and that particular form of curiosity? It's an unusual
Well, we generally, it's not easy to find, and we have people, and some don't work and some do, but in general the type of person is a man for the textile industry who has been in a textile, gone to a textile school or studied chemistry generally, or maybe chemical engineering, and then gone to work in a mill where he's put in to solve problems. And some smart ones come out of this that have a feel, understand, and do. That's the type of a person. It's rare that if anybody works for us hasn't worked in the field.
So you'll be recruiting people after they've been out there for a number.
That's right. That's right. Usually, we try to get young people. A man may have been in the mill 4 or 5 years, but he shows promise. We're tipped off that he's good. We try to hire him. That's the way it goes.
Let me change the subject.
Go ahead.
Take you across into
history?
Cross-fertilization. Into history. And maybe, can we talk about your interest in the history of dye stuffs and of...
Oh, you want chemistry or the whole thing or what?
Well, we all... Eventually we want to get all parts of your historical interest. But I'm wondering how we may pick it up.
Well, my interest in the history of dye stuff did not come before my interest in the history of chemistry. It simply was a natural subsection in the history of chemistry. But it didn't come first and then the history of chemistry. But they all came pretty close together at the thing very early. I don't know exactly what... I think the whole history story is the thing, if you want.
Oh, yeah.
And we can separate. I think you start. Firstly, my interest in the history of chemistry came firstly as an interest in old things, number one, number two, old books as such. And I can tell you this, that when I was at MIT, I was taking a bachelor's degree my last year, I was forced to take a course in the history of chemistry, which was held on Saturday by Tenny L. Davis. Huh? I told you that story.
Yeah. Well, don't know. Go.
But Saturday, when I was taking the course, I was already married in chemistry. I'm not married in chemistry. Already married. And the idea of going in on Saturday morning just to listen to the history of chemistry seemed awful to me. But I was afraid I might not get a degree if I didn't take it. So I went in and I was almost ready to sleep through the class because Friday night we were out. And it wasn't until Tenny Davis one day brought in some old chemical books that all of a sudden I woke up and developed an interest. Not because it was chemistry, but because I was involved in chemistry and there were old things available, which happened to be concerned with chemistry. So it started that way.
Were you already interested in old books?
I was interested in old things. I grew up, I wrote a thing in the preface, I explained how I got into this. Did you ever see this catalog of our first exhibition at the...
something in
the whole preface is how I got in the history of chemistry.
Sure.
I mean, let me get that and now I can almost quote from it. Because
we pick up if you... Is it him?
Yeah.
Well, let's stop from...
Yeah, stop a minute because... You have this on?
Yeah.
I think what you're interested in is the relationship of history of dye stuffs and dyeing as connection with Dexter and the use and promotion, public relations, etc.
But I also want to go a little bit behind that to some of your publications in the field and your promotion of some other research. I think that as early as
Well, these papers that I did that were technical papers are separate and unrelated to history.
I think you're, if I'm correct, your earliest...
Your interest in the chemistry of dying arose out of your interest in the history of chemistry,
yes,
which arose out of your interest in history.
Very early, because I was involved in the textile industry. Obviously, dyes and dyeing, etc., would be an important point. Also, I found that no one had ever really studied dyes and dyeing quite like they had other aspects of history, chemistry, and I felt that this was a wonderful, exciting thing for me. And I also found that it was a useful tool for bringing up the feelings of the dyer, the so-called textile chemist. And I want to make certain points where I feel history of a profession and the techniques of a profession are very important for the good of the profession, not just for the specialist who's interested. And I give you my whole idea because I think it's important and it should be used more. When I started out as a chemical manufacturer, and you might call almost a textile chemist, in general, the man who was the textile chemist in most textile plants was not really a chemist in the normal sense. He was a dyer.
Did
I miss all this stuff?
No, it's in there, but plug it in.
Should I start again?
No, I think we've got it.
All right. In any case, what I want to review is the importance of the history of a profession and the techniques of a profession for the good of the members of the profession. And I picked the dye industry and the dyes because it suffered in a way from a certain internal self-respect. When I started in the textile field, wet processing textile field, in general, the man who was concerned with the chemical side of the wet processing of textiles was rarely a chemist or rarely called a chemist, and usually he was the dyer, which meant that his expertise was in the matching of color and the picking of dyes to give particular results, etc. For some peculiar reason, the profession, while important and often well paid, had fallen into a sort of disrespect. It was much nicer to be a chemist or scientist than to say you were simply a dyer. Oh, many dyers were very excellent technical people. Now, in my own early study of the history of dyeing and dyes and dyeing, it was important to me that in France, one of the biggest accolades that could be given to one of their great chemists was to make him chief dyer of the Gobelins, for example, our great chemist Chevreul, who did so much in the history of the development of organic chemistry and many other things and color science, finished his last days more or less as the chief dyer of the Gobelins tapestry works. And I felt that history could be used for several ways for help for the ordinary dyer in the plant. One, if he saw some of the origins of dyes and dyeing and realized how actually it was responsible for the earliest chemical industry in the world and responsible for many other developments, for our great pharmaceutical industry, for everything else, he would feel stronger, have more respect for his own profession. Secondly, I felt that the average technical man, had no real interest other than in technical things. And it's a way to get him into the field of liberal arts or economics or general history or whatever we might want to call, would be to introduce it through his own profession. So my real interest in the history of dies and dying was threefold. One, it satisfied my own great interest in simply history of a field that I was close to. Two, it offered me a way to build the respect of the dye industry for the dyers, and also for the outside world to have respect for the profession. And thirdly, it offered a way, as I said, to introduce some of the dyers into a whole world that they had never paid attention to. Now, my way of doing it was by writing a series of simple papers that dwelled on some mundane theme, usually something that was happening in the paper or happening daily, and bring the dyer into the history of some facet of his profession. And I got the American Dye Stuff Reporter, which was the official organ of the American Association of Textile Chemists and Colorists, to agree to publish over quite a number of years, articles that I would write with this particular group of ideas in mind. And what I found was a greatly increasing interest in the field of history by the average dyer. Now, not only I didn't just write papers, but I gave talks and presented the same type of information to various sections or groups of dyers and textile chemists all over the United States. And I found different ways of getting an interest. I managed to bring along, for example,
this was in the 1940s.
Yeah. 40s, 50s, 60s, all the way through. For example, if I was invited to give a historical talk at the textile chemists whose headquarters for their section might be in Greenville, South Carolina, I managed to bring along and talk a great deal about Samuel Cooper, for example, who wrote one of the first books on textile printing in the United States, a great book, and who is buried in the cemetery of the church in Columbia, South Carolina, where all these textile people know. Now, Thomas Cooper was important in politics and everything else, but this was a way to bring these men into a recognition. They never heard of Thomas Cooper. They didn't realize that he had been president of the University of South Carolina and all these other things. And they seemed to be thrilled about the connection between somebody important like that in the history of the United States and their own profession. I cite this as just one of many hundreds of examples. For example, in another related field, in some of the New England towns where there were important textile customers, certain ones, a Unitarian church was an important church for some of the chemists and dyers in the town. And Edelstein would manage to be invited to speak to them about Joseph Priestley and the history of chemistry and the history of their church in their church, all of which brought them into a very different feeling about their professions and about their whole life. It also, there was a fall off, which was a very important thing for Dexter, and which was not my original idea. Dexter became very well known around the country and in the industry for historical things. Furthermore, our competitors would bring up the idea that every time an article appeared by Sidney Edelstein, Dexter Chemical Corporation, Dexter was getting free advertisement. Free advertisement, the name of the company and the thing and the promotion. And they said, well, why should this company be getting this? But the editor, who was honest and realized that there was something useful being done, said, fine, you write any articles like Edelstein can do and Dexter presents, and we'll be glad to publish them. The point is that nobody was around who could do it. We did further things. We were invited. I was invited for two things. One, interest in history became such, after a few years of talking and writing about the history of dyes and dyeing, is that the American Association sent their officers to speak to me that there should be a real history of the association, and their records were not in shape and anything like that. So I agreed to take over a committee, and actually I became an archivist. I went to some of the original founders of the company, sought out letters of the association, and we set up, finally, an archive, which is now part of a big exhibition at their national headquarters in the Research Triangle. And there was so much interest in that that Dexter was invited when the annual conventions, when different companies had booths trying to sell their, showing their chemicals or whatever. Dexter said, we don't have to do that. We'll be glad to set up a booth showing the beginnings of the association, the archives, and some of the books that bear on the history of our industry, etc. One of the most popular exhibits around. What could be better advertising? I mean, it was all this was a fallout. Now, this type of thing became popular to the point where the Lowell Textile, it was Textile Institute in those days. Today is Lowell Institute of Technology, but in those days it was a textile thing. Realized that this was possibly a way to introduce what we call broadly the liberal arts to their students who were studying dyeing. In other words, introduce history through their courses in dyeing or economics or other things. And this was tried, for example, some of the papers I worked with them, some of the papers that I'd written, for example, Napoleon offering a prize for the red to be made a certain way. Why? Because you then go into the fact that there was an embargo on stuff from France and they couldn't get things from Mexico, etc. So it brought them all, each of these things did. The thing fell apart. Finally, the principle is still correct, but you could not find enough people who were chemists and taught dyeing who had enough background to talk and to get into other things. And that, to me, is a great failing even today in the use of history of a profession or a science into the thing for the people, not just for the history of the chemistry, but to bring them into others. If there is a man who is broad in his education, he can do it. And that means, in general, to me, many of the professors of dyeing, chemistry, physics, and etc., to take charge of a group of the younger people entering the professions, to get them on the right track, should be a liberal, educated man broadly. And the worst thing in the world is to have a physicist, only a physicist. This is a push, I'm saying here, for a person who has physics and history, chemistry. The unfortunate thing is that many of the historians today don't know a goddamn thing about the science. But I mean, that in between is so needed, and I still preach this and still try it and make little attempts different places to do it. But getting back to the history of dyes and dyeing, as far as Dexter is concerned, it has been a wonderful promotion thing for the name of the company. And Dexter has always promoted historical things because we're the only ones that are accepted to do it. Everybody else doesn't dare do it. And the Edelstein Library for a long time, my own, was called the Dexter Library, and we had beautiful prints made up of different historical things that would call plays from the Dexter Library. And I can go around today into many, many laboratory offices all over the United States and see these historical things of Dexter hanging on the wall, and they're proud of it and interested. So that's the story of that and Dexter. We are known as the historical company. In addition, there have been competitors and other people who wanted to run historical ads, and I've agreed to send them engravings or whatnot or whatever they wanted to use in their ad, but they always give credit to the Dexter Library.
In terms of the research interests within the history of dye stuffs and
yeah.
dyeing, and I'm thinking of the pearl and then the most recently the Korean
well,
purple. Can you talk down that theme? Of
yes. Now there is another field, how the history of dyes and dyeing have led me into another cross-fertilization of different fields. For example, in my early studies in the history of dyes and dyeing, I began to realize that maybe, how do we know that what they wrote is really so? That the only way would begin to look at artifacts from the periods when this was written. Now, this leads into the field of using analytical work in modern chemistry to study some of these things. Now, the first thing that involved Dexter and me, and Dexter has always been willing to help people and to do work and to do laboratory work and use our chemists for historical things. And it costs a lot of money. I mean, it's not cheap to do this, but we've done it always free of charge. I've told you this about the Barcosa things, haven't I? Are you familiar with them?
But not in this context.
No, the original... All right, let me... You want this stuff? The original way that I was got involved into the use of chemistry and other sciences to tie up with the history of a field came about this way. Sometime about 1960, I mean, I've got it in my purple book, but you can look, check the date. About 1960, I was in Israel and invited to the Hebrew University for lunch. And at the lunch was a professor of zoology. And he says to me, "I know your interest in the history of dyes and dyeing. Professor General Yadin has made some discoveries of a bunch of textiles in the Bar Kokhba caves. And they were brought to me. I can analyze some of the seeds that they find, but I don't know anything about the dyes. And they need to know something about how are these dyes made, what about it. Will you do it? Will you tell us?" I said, "I'd be happy to." Now, there were at that time, no exact methods for the analysis of dyes on ancient textiles. No complete way. There were little pieces of things. And we set up, using with my man who at that time was my chief chemist, he still is our technical director, we developed some techniques so that we could determine the dye stuffs, the mordants, and the whole things, and be absolutely certain. It was done by infrared comparison, but the big thing was extracting the materials out and getting in a form so we could get exact infrared curves. Now, that particular piece of work was astounding to me, because we found in this work that in the year 135 A.D., they were using dyeing techniques which, according to our books, had only come into prominence in France in the 17th century. Now, that showed that things were not quite the way, and things also were different. And the specific thing was that black has always been a key dye. The cheap way, a normal way of making, you got it, or should I stop?